We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft. But Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
From Pod World Headquarters, this is the Carolina Insider from Learfield IMG College, presented by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. We resolve to help North Carolina stay healthy.
We're back. Time for another edition of the Carolina Insider. Jones and Adam here with you. The show presented by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, reminding you to practice your three W's: wear, wait, and wash. And resolve to help North Carolina stay healthy. Adam, we need to reboot the wear, wait, and wash. That's the that's what happened.
I think that's the problem in Tallahassee. I thought about that after the game. Now we need to officially decree Wake Forest is the wear.
Yep. So it'll go Wake is wear, State your weight, which...
appropriate.
Yep. And then it's time to wash against Pittsburgh.
Yep.
Then we'll reboot the wear, wait, wash.
Yeah.
Just a little three-game. Just take this three games at a time.
Yeah. It's like Michael Gaskin's telling the realtor that he's sang the Wake is Fake song.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that, except it's instead of Wake is Fake, Wake is Wash.
Yeah. Wait, no, Wake is Where.
Wake is Where.
Yeah.
Wake is Where. State is Wait. No, I think this is my potential.
Yeah, State's Wait.
Yeah.
And Pitt's Wash.
Yeah.
Now you got it.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, we got a little off topic there.
Or were we right
Or are we right where we need to be? We'll look back at Florida State game. Adam, sometimes the other team has the right to try and win the game, too. I don't know if you know that. We'll look ahead to Wake Forest. Wake is a mystery to me, Adam. They've barely played any games. They have a bunch of new players and a new coach. There, that's our preview.
Randolph Childress, not on the team anymore.
That game is game time change, by the way.
That should count as a victory in the one loss column.
So instead of 9 o'clock on Wednesday night, that's a 7 o'clock game.
Big win.
And so we'll preview that. And Adam, then a little off the beaten path guest for us today, as Jerry McGee, probably a name that you don't immediately recognize, longtime official, including multiple national championship games on the football side of things, Army-Navy games, big bowl games. So we talked to him about his career in officiating. His son, Ryan McGee, is, you may know Ryan from ESPN. And Jerry McGee has also done a bunch of other cool stuff, but we mostly talked to him about...
like been president of universities, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. We talked to him about football. And actually, Adam, a really fun interview.
Great storyteller. He's got some hilarious stories, and it was really fun to catch up with him.
Yeah, so I think you're going to enjoy that. That's coming up in a little bit. Adam has a list and more. I say that without knowing if Adam has a list.
Yeah, that was very presumptive.
Yeah. The show is brought to you in part by LS Tractor. Don't let you, I did some outside chores. I raked leaves on Sunday.
Did you use an LS Tractor?
I just used a rake.
Oh.
But
is
I will
an LS rake?
I will say, Adam, that I have definitely moved into old man land because after I raked the leaves, I brought the outdoor outdoor trash bin. You know what I mean? The
big plastic one.
Yeah, the big brown one that they come and pick up on Fridays at my house.
Right.
What a day that is. The outside trash bin. And so I've got to scoop the leaves up and dump them in the bin. Well, that involves a lot of hamstring work, Adam. And let me just tell you, I can feel it. I felt it on Monday.
I can't wait until people start tweeting pictures of your leaf bin to us.
Yeah, that's right. Guys, I got a good look at Jones's leaf bin. Here it is.
Here's Jones bent over grabbing his knee.
Here's Jones injured because he's torn his hamstring picking up leaves. So that would be an example of normal yard maintenance. Mm. There's also larger projects. Those are the ones Adam tackles.
Right.
Like excavation.
Yes.
Full yard reboots. LS Tractor has the machine for you. LSTractorUSA.com. See the difference. LS Tractor, what's it about for you? Adam, Carolina was in Tallahassee on Saturday and lost to Florida State 82-75. And I have mixed feelings on this game. Adam, one, I did not think the Tar Heels played poorly. They didn't play well enough to win against a really good team who played really well, I thought, in Florida State. But there's the simple fact is the Tar Heels lost and they're 8-5, which is not a sparkling record. I think Carolina is better than that record would suggest, but that's the season that they're in and the record that they currently have with a difficult schedule still to play. Carolina has no breaks this year. I do think Carolina is getting better. I do think the Tar Heels are on the right path. And yet, there were still some of the same mistakes that came up and bit Carolina. Turnovers at bad times, defensive miscues at bad times. The Tar Heels shot the ball pretty well in this game, but so did Florida State. I mean, Florida State was 8 of 16 from 3 and only missed one free throw. They were 26 of 27. And I thought the ultimate answer to this game was it felt like Florida State was just, and we used the word pressure, I think, when talking about them on Friday, they just kept putting pressure on Carolina, whether that was defensive pressure or pressure by scoring. It just felt like they were aggressive the entire game, and Carolina was aggressive some of the game, but not the entire game. And I thought that ended up being the difference.
Florida State's good.
They're good.
We said beforehand we thought they were the best team in the ACC that Carolina would have played, and I still think that now that Carolina's played them. They were without Scotty Barnes, who by all accounts is one of their best players and certainly one of their, maybe he's got the most unique skill set of their players, but they didn't seem to miss him very much because unless he shoots 95%, he would have been right in line with them. So they're deep and good and they've got older guys. But that being said, I thought this was the rare game where you could come out of it justifiably either encouraged or really frustrated, because I think a normal Carolina team probably wins that game because there were opportunities to do things that would have turned the game around. I think it was in the second half, Carolina had 9 possessions in a 4-point game or less, and they only scored on one of them. And the one was when Caleb Love stole the ball at midcourt and went in and dunked it. I mean, you got to score on that one. But the other 8 either turned the ball over or missed shots, sometimes several shots. And you just can't win on the road that way in the ACC against a good team. You have to take advantage of those possessions. Coach Williams always says, make them pay on offensive rebounds. Well, you got to make them pay when you've got a chance to, as you said, put a little pressure back on them. Carolina wasn't able to swing the pressure back over to Florida State and force them to do something. And You've got to make those plays. You've got to make those shots. You can't turn the ball over in those situations, and Carolina did that too often also.
Yeah, I don't – the Tar Heels did not rebound to the level that they normally rebound, but Florida State's bigger than a lot of the teams that Carolina's played. I thought that Carolina did a good job handling the basketball for like the first 15 minutes, but then the last 25 minutes did not do as good a job and had some key turnovers in the second half. Two got Raekwon Gray and Balsha Koprivica, not the top players on Florida State. They both had big days and stepped up. You know, Koprivica had 10 points and 9 rebounds, 3 blocks. And I know all the points came in the second half, and I think most of the production in total came in the second half for him. Gray, who had a career high last year against Carolina with 12, now had a career high 19 against them this year. He's just a difficult matchup for the Tar Heels for whatever reason. He plays well against them. And again, it never felt like the Tar Heels could quite match that level of intensity, at least consistently, as Florida State did. And Adam, the last two games have been really big games as far as runs by each team. You know, so one team will go on a 10-1 run, then the other team will go on an 8-0 run or whatever. And so, and certainly that happens in basketball, but I think with this team, it's a good example of kind of where they are, because they have some moments, and they had moments in this game where you go, ooh, okay, the Tar Heels are getting this figured out. And then all of a sudden they go through a stretch where it's maybe not. And so the consistency just isn't there. Again, I do think the Tar Heels are getting better, but as we've said multiple times, they're trying to get better in conference play, and that's just hard to do.
We've mentioned this before, but part of that consistency has got to be Carolina's got to get better playmaking. The last four games, Garrison Brooks has more assists than RJ Davis and Caleb Love put together. That shouldn't be the case. Even though you played a Syracuse team where you're using Brooks as kind of a facilitator, they're supposed to be the facilitator all the time. And I thought it really highlighted it when Anthony Harris came in and all of a sudden was that facilitator, and you realized what had been missing, because he was making the correct pass and he was making one extra pass for a teammate to get an open shot. And you've just got to get that more consistently. That the pass that Caleb Love threw, like the one-handed bounce pass, I think to Brooks,
where he's trying to spin it real low, and
like, this isn't the Peach Jam.
Right.
This is ACC basketball. You might be able to make that pass, but you cannot make it one-handed that way. It's too casual. You just, in the second half, and you're trying to come back, you cannot not make that pass. And if you can't understand that, then you can't play point guard in that situation, because the ball's too valuable. And I know that's something that Roy Williams has said to every point guard since Raymond Felton: don't throw a one-handed bounce pass. We have both heard him say that at least 100 times. And to just make that play at that time, I thought just really showed what was missing and what wasn't connecting in terms of the offense, that seemed like a viable, good thing to do. You just can't do that. And I think Carolina's missing that. But, you know, maybe Harris provides you some of that. But no matter how much people want him to be, he's not a point guard.
Well, that does bring us to Anthony Harris, Adam, which was a big part of this game, where we had been talking about how we felt as though he was getting closer. He kind of snuck in there, like randomly during a free throw or something early in the second half when he checked in. And we hadn't seen Anthony Harris in a while. It had been December 30th, I think, of 2019 against Yale when he tore his ACL. And Adam, he looked, it was a good refresher of what he brought to Carolina. And he played 8.5 minutes, 5 points, 3 assists, no turnovers. He was 2 for 2 from the floor, including a three-pointer. Played really good. I mean, I said this on the air. It showed you what Carolina thinks of Anthony Harris's defensive ability, that in his first game in more than a calendar year, they put him on MJ Walker, who's one of the better players in the ACC. And so Anthony Harris provides Carolina something. The energy in which he plays, his individual defensive ability, and it just seems like he's just one of those guys who gets basketball. He's just, as you said, he's in the right place. He makes the right pass. He's just somebody who, in the, again, very limited amount of time that we have seen him play as a Tar Heel, He just makes plays that help your team. And no matter what it is, he seems to be involved in it. And, you know, how quickly can he get to the point that he can play 15 or 20 minutes, both with his physical conditioning and how he and the coaching staff trust his knees? I don't know that answer. Where do those minutes come from? I don't know that answer either. But it was clear when he was on the court, Carolina felt different when he was out there.
I think you feel so much better about him because he did make that 1 3-pointer. I don't think that's his thing. I think he's going to, well, obviously, he's going to miss more than he makes, as most people do. I don't think he's a shooter, but I think he might make enough to at least make you worry about him.
I think
probably better if they took 100 3-pointers, I think he'd make fewer than Kerwin Walton, but probably more than Leaky Black. And I think that's roughly where he falls. But all the other stuff is stuff that it feels like this year's team needs. But I thought Roy Williams was pretty clear, as you hit on, that he's not comfortable playing him a large amount of minutes right now. Does that mean right now this season or right now mid-January? I think that's what we're going to need to see as things progress. But he clearly is valuable, and Roy Williams clearly trusts him. And I think that tells you he is going to play. Do the minutes come from Leaky Black? I think you'd need his defense too. I mean, potentially, if you've got the good version of defensive Leaky Black and Anthony Harris, all of a sudden you look really good on the perimeter defensively. But what about putting the ball in the basket? You can't take minutes away from Kerwin Walton because he is your threat to put it in the basket all the time. And no one else is presenting that same level of concern for opposing defenses. So now you're down to Caleb Love and R.J. Davis. I thought R.J. Davis was pretty good on Saturday.
He's played well the last two games.
Caleb Love shot it better on Saturday, and overall he's trending up in shooting. I think in other areas of the game, he's trending about the same.
0 assists, 4 turnovers on Saturday.
Those are the areas where he's trending about the same. But, like, he's good. We've seen him be good all summer and fall. Playing point guard, driving to the basket, getting to the free throw line.
This Carolina's not the first team that can play the violin and feel this sad story, Adam. I feel like if this group stayed together for a year or two more, and who knows what's going to happen after this year. But certainly Caleb Love has aspirations of the NBA, as does, well, everyone on the team. So I don't know how long this particular group is going to be together. But if this one was together for 2 or 3 years, it would be this would be a national championship caliber team. As we know, that's not what college basketball is right now, unfortunately. And we'll just it's got to happen in fast forward. So how quickly does it happen? I don't know. And by the way, just one more point about Anthony Harris. The plus minus isn't the end-all, be-all basketball stat. I do find it as an interesting stat. But, like, for example, Armando Bacot was minus 10 on Saturday. I didn't think that he played to the level that you would think that Carolina was 10 points worse than Florida State when he was on the court. But, again, I do think sometimes it's useful. Anthony Harris was plus – the team was plus 10 in the 8.5 minutes that he was on the court.
Which was the team high, if I remember
that correctly. That is correct, yes. The next closest person in plus was Andrew Playtech at plus 2.
And I think when you talk your way through the backcourt and you come to the realization that everyone presents you some positive, but there's not really one at this individual at this point who does everything, then number one, you wish you had had all those non-conference games when you would have figured out stuff like this.
Yes.
And number two, you just got to trust whoever's in charge. It's the Hall of Fame head coach, Roy Williams. He's in charge of figuring out how to use those pieces in the most effective way to win games. He's not going to be able to make Leaky Black shoot it like Kerwin Walton, and he's not going to be able to make Kerwin Walton defend like Leaky Black. So how do you use them in which situations to give Carolina the best chance to win? That's the job going forward.
I know we've beat this drum a bunch, and you could say it for everybody. But if Carolina had played five more games or six more games or something or whatever it would have worked out to be, and they were 13-5 right now or 14-5 instead of 8-5 because you beat Tennessee Tech and Elon in the preseason or in the pre-conference, I think you'd feel a lot different about that. I think that record is blinding you right now. And I'm not saying you, Adam. I'm just saying the general thought about Carolina. And maybe I'm going to be proven wrong. I just think that this team is going to be good. I think it's getting better. And I think they're one of those teams that if they're in the tournament, which I think the Tar Heels will get there, that you'd be like, ooh. I mean, if the Tar Heels are a 5 seed or something or a 7 seed and you're looking at them, you're like, ooh, I don't know if I want to play them.
Yes, the challenge is getting to
that. You got to get there. You got to get there.
Against what's left on the schedule.
I mean, there's still, you know, Carolina plays Florida State again. They still have at least one scheduled game against Clemson and maybe two. They play at Virginia. They still play Duke twice. They play Virginia Tech one time, who's apparently good. So, I don't know.
Well, and I guess we can just touch on this now. I know we've given the ACC a bit of a hard time about the basketball schedule, but it's January 19th. It's time to rip up what's left of the basketball schedule and just start over. Just start over. Put somebody in the ACC office in charge of tearing up everything that's on paper. It's dumb if Carolina plays NC State this weekend, which who knows at this point. It's dumb to have played them twice before you play other teams and might not ever play other teams.
Right.
Use that hole in the schedule to play someone that you haven't already played, that you maybe were supposed to play. But don't be beholden to this document that you came up with in October when you somehow blindly thought that everything was going to occur exactly like you wrote it down. Don't be beholden to that sheet of paper. Just tear it up and say, all right, we're starting from today. We're going to leave some holes in the schedule. We're getting rid of the ACC tournament. And we're going to make a new schedule. And I know this is difficult for everybody for travel and all that, but this makes more sense to try to get in some semblance of a reasonable conference schedule to give our teams the best chance of making the all-important NCAA tournament, which is the only reason we're doing this, to try to get to that moment. Someone's going to not make the tournament because their conference schedule is so tilted that their record looks bad.
Yeah.
So that is going to happen in the ACC this year if they don't do something about the schedule. And I have no indication that they have any thought of doing anything like that.
Nah.
I think we're just barreling down the tracks.
Yes.
Believing that everything is going to happen exactly like it is. You might sometime notice that, oh, look, on the official Carolina schedule, the home game against Notre Dame is no longer there.
Yeah, just gone.
But we didn't put anything in that place.
Because no one knows.
Because no one has any idea. Figure out the games that need to be played and make a schedule with those games so that we can have a reasonable conference year and not some year where some team finishes 7-2 in the league and we have to decide, are they actually good?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to, and we talked that this, if you were going to try to do football, you had to be okay, remember, with one team playing 11 and one team playing 6 or whatever it was. But I think the same principle applies for basketball, but it's so much different because of the way the postseason is. So let's say, and I'm just picking teams, let's say Clemson ends up at 8-1 in conference play, but that's all they play, and then Virginia is 13-4. Well, wait a second. So Clemson's percentage would be better, so do they win? And what does that mean for the tournament? And, I mean, it's just, it's very, it just doesn't feel real organized right now. It's just, it is day by day. It almost feels like hour by hour of, oh, wait, now this team, okay, well, let's see how we can shuffle the deck here and see how it makes sense now that we know this piece of information.
And it's like we're surprised every time.
Right.
Like we're sitting here with our hands over our eyes our hands over our ears.
Uh-oh, guys, you got another one.
Someone's got COVID? How could we have foreseen this? Well, let's postpone this one game and then, but not make any other arrangements otherwise, and then we'll just proceed merrily along with our hands over our eyes some more.
I mean, even this game this past weekend, after the game was over, I was giving the final records. I mean, Carolina's played four more games than Florida State. Four. I think Wake's played, what, seven or eight games total? Carolina's played 13. That's crazy. Anyway.
Jim Phillips will fix all this, I'm sure.
So it is Wake Forest on Wednesday, and then again, State is scheduled on Saturday, but State has did not play this past weekend, is not going to play in the midweek. They're on their second break for COVID. And so they had, according to Kevin Keats on Monday in the ACC teleconference, five tier one people, which is like players and coaches or immediate staff members that are currently in quarantine. So that means here are the two scenarios the Tar Heels face. They either don't play or they play State, who would be coming off about a 10-day respite after the Tar Heels have played more games than anybody else in the league.
Or the third scenario, with which Carolina is very familiar, find out on Thursday that you're actually playing someone else on Saturday.
Guys, instead, we're going to send you to Miami. You go down there. I know you've already been there, but you guys just go play them again. They can play.
We wondered if you'd mind playing two games in Charlottesville this year because we just had an opening on this. Well, you know who's off this weekend.
Who's that?
Wake Forest.
Well, that doesn't help things, Adam.
I can totally imagine a scenario where the league decides, you know what?
Well, while we're doing this, I'm just going to one more time say it makes no sense that Carolina's playing Virginia once this year, Virginia Tech once this year, and Wake Forest once this year. Those are teams that the Tar Heels can easily go play, and those teams can easily get to Chapel Hill to come play, and you can do it on a bus. You could do it day of if you had to. I mean, how that didn't happen still blows my mind.
And that's what ought to happen when they tear up the schedule and make a new schedule and go, guys, we blew it. There's nothing wrong with saying you blew it. Everybody does at some point. Everybody messes up. Sometimes you get the final score wrong in the rapid reactions. Yeah. It happens.
What kind of idiot would do that?
Just start over and say, look, Carolina should be playing Wake Forest twice. Those are easy games for us to make happen. Here's the new schedule. You play Wake Forest twice.
Right. So,
and it's not to make it easier for Carolina. That's not what we're saying. Virginia Tech's good.
Virginia's
good.
Yeah.
Clemson's good. All the close teams are good.
So, it is Carolina Wake Wednesday at 7 o'clock. And again, Wake Forest, new head coach. They have a lot of new players. They did not play the entire month of December. So, it's just, who knows? They won their first three. They've lost, I think it's five in a row, but most of them have been close. It seems like Steve Forbes is a good coach. I think he's fiery and scrappy. And I think Wake's going to be fiery and scrappy. He's still getting them in his image. I think in like 2 years, they're going to be fiery and scrappy and no one wants to play them.
And I would say the same thing about them that I would say about Carolina. If they had had those December games, we'd know much more about are they actually good or not. But instead, because they didn't play, they're basically playing like their mid-December cohesiveness right now. So they might show up and be awesome tomorrow night. I think there's a chance of that. Or they might show up and not be good at all because that might be who they are. But look, their record doesn't really tell you anything.
One more thing, Adam, and then we'll get to our conversation with Jeremy Gee. This has nothing to do with pandemic scheduling, just scheduling in general. I think the 20 conference games hurts Carolina because the Tar Heels, and I mean, no team's their best team on December 15th. But you're playing a conference game that is going to carry a lot of weight on those days. So, I mean, that's just going to be the norm from now on is you're going to play at least one and probably two conference games before the holiday break. And it's just those games are too impactful to be playing that early, I feel like. I mean, I feel like you should have some control as your individual team of your schedule before you get into after the holiday when you're playing conference stuff. You should be able to say, you know what, this year we need to play some not as good teams because we're a young team and we need to gain some confidence. This year, oh, we've got a team that I feel like, you know, it's going to best benefit us to really be challenged, to go on the road and play these teams. Plus, Carolina already knows, and ACC teams already know, they're going to play that ACC Big Ten Challenge. Tar Heels are going to play in that CBS Sports Classic. So they should have more control over the games than I feel like moving to 20 conference. There's no flexibility in your schedule anymore. You don't know who you play.
That's part of running a program, is deciding how you want to ramp up your team.
Yes.
Like, are you Syracuse and you want to play everyone at the Carrier Dome and beat them by 25?
And that's fine if you want to do that.
It works for them. Are you Carolina and you want to go on the road a fair amount? Are you some other teams that never, ever, ever, never, ever want to leave home? That seems to work for them too. But you should have the ability to do that. When you lose the ability to do that is when your conference is more focused on providing television programming than on determining a champion.
You know where this is never a problem, Adam?
Pinehurst?
Pinehurst. It's always easy going at Pinehurst, whether you're playing Donald Ross's masterpiece number 2, maybe you are taking in the stunning redesign of number 4, maybe you're playing the cradle on a Saturday afternoon with the kiddos, Rusty. Maybe you're at the North and South Bar, Rusty. Or maybe you're at the Pinehurst Brewing Company. There's never been more to discover at the cradle of American golf. Pinehurst.com and plan your visit. All right, let's get to our conversation. I'm going to tell you something. This is one of these where you're going to go, I don't know who that is. You will enjoy this interview. I Adam guarantees it.
You will enjoy this interview, or else we're going to get as mad at you as we are about the basketball schedule, and no one wants that.
So let me just give you a couple of teasers here. What happens when the ref mic goes out? What's the hardest that Jerry McGee's ever been hit by a player on the field? What head coach was intoxicated on the sideline during a game? These are all general questions that you will get answers to in our conversation with Jerry McGee. We'll do that. Come back. More to do on the Carolina Insider.
Jones, do you ever have that situation where you're about to talk to someone on a podcast and you know them as one thing?
Right.
And then you're reading up on them and you're like, whoa, wait a minute. This person is in the North Carolina Sports Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
This person has received the Order of the Longleaf Pine.
Mm-hmm.
This person has written multiple books.
This happens to me all the time.
But all we really want to do is talk to him about pass interference, which doesn't seem quite right. So Jerry McGee is with us today. You know him, and we know him, as a longtime ACC football official. He is the co-author of the new book, Sidelines and Bloodlines, with Ryan McGee, who you may know from ESPN, who also once shared a baseball broadcast booth with us at,
nice.
Where, UNC Charlotte?
I think that's right.
So clearly a highly decorated family, but also Jerry McGee, he's been a university president. He's done all kinds of things. But again, what about pass interference? Jerry, thanks so much for being with us today. Give people a little window into how you began this officiating journey.
Yeah. Well, it all began with, as things often do begin, with a need for money. when I was in college, I was a Mill Hill kid, and I was lucky to have enough money to pay my tuition and room and board, and I never had any extra money. And the intramural program at East Carolina was looking for football officials to come out and officiate Sigma Nu and Pica and those kind of things. And so I went out and started officiating some games with them and made a few bucks, and then wound up being the director of the student intramural program, where I hired the officials and trained them. And then from there, I moved to junior high and high school, and on you go.
What appealed to you about doing that? Because I feel like some people just aren't equipped to handle some of the negative things that come with that job.
Well, it's just being part of the game. You know, when your playing career is over, you know, maybe you can become a broadcaster, but probably not. So you look at it, and maybe you can be a coach, but probably not. So you're looking for some place where you can fit into the game that you love so much. And officiating was it for me. And I, You know, I never heard much of the carrying on and screaming and hollering, that sort of stuff. One of my high school teammates asked me recently, said, how in the world did you concentrate on the game when 85,000 people were screaming? And I told him, I said, yeah, I never knew they were there. I was just one of seven guys. We were doing our job, and the 22 players were playing, and the coaches were coaching, and we were just having a big time being a part of college football.
So how does it go from you're throwing a flag against Sigma Nu to you're doing it at the college level? That seems like a big step forward. How did that occur?
Well, it is a big step forward, but I will tell you that I've always said if you could officiate a Pike and Sigma Nu, you can handle Michigan Notre Dame. Because you had a lot of things that you had to deal with at Sigma Nu Pike you didn't have to deal with the college game. But it was different. And, you know, it's I actually found when I started working small college football, I actually found that easier to work than to work the high school games, because you were jumping in the car after work on a Friday afternoon and driving somewhere and dressing in an inadequate dressing room and going out officiating on a field where you could hardly see and the lighting was so bad. And then you're working day games in major stadiums and the facilities were so great and you could see. It was really kind of it was easier, I thought.
I would have to assume that there are some good stories from the high school / small college officiating days. Are there one or two that you enjoy retelling that you could share with us?
Hey, you never knew what to expect when you went to a small college football game. You hoped they would have some place for you to dress, but usually it was terribly inadequate. Maybe had formerly been a bathroom, would be a place for officials to dress. But I remember once we went over to a game at Carson Newman, and they, as a big game, and they had sold all the rooms and forgot to save one for us. So we show up with nowhere to dress. And finally, they took us back in this room, and it had about three keys to this room, and finally got it open. And there were all mattresses in there and everything, but he threw a few towels in. And for some reason, there were chicken feathers everywhere. I guess the feathers had come out of the mattresses. I don't know. But the boy, the other fish and I had so much fun laughing and talking about that. And Bill Wampler and I were in that game together. And ironically, 9 years later, we're working the national championship together. And the facilities in Miami were a little better than they were in Jefferson City.
So right at the kickoff, you had thrown a flag for an unsuitable warm-up facility for the official. 15-yard penalty on Carson Newman. Hate to break it to you.
We always packed soap. We always packed towels, because you literally never knew if you were going to have some place to dress or not. Or you knew you probably wouldn't have a towel unless you carried one. But it was all part of it. And you know, you kind of go with the bad days and enjoy the good ones.
You had a great story in the book about a game you did at Lenoir Rhine when the visiting coach was no longer coaching that team a few days later. Could you tell us that story, please?
Sure. I knew Henry Van Sant from East Carolina days. He was on the football staff there when I was at East Carolina. And I wasn't playing football, but I knew all the coaches. And Henry was the coach of Lenoir Rhine. So he comes in with the referee and the umpire before the game, and they're all in a panic. And, Jerry, you got to do something. You got to do something. And I'm like, well, what do you want me to do? And they said, well, the other team didn't bring their home jerseys. They didn't bring their white jerseys, as the visiting team is supposed to bring. And I said, well, what do you want me to do? Go talk to the coach. So I went and talked to the coach, explained to him he was the visiting team. He had to wear white jerseys. And he said, well, we didn't bring them. So we just gonna wear the ones we brought. And I said, well, don't think we'll let you do that. But I went back to the coach Van Sant and said, what are we gonna do? He said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll give him our white practice jerseys. He can wear those. And I said, oh, that'll work. So I go back and tell the coach again. I said, okay, I got it worked out. They're gonna let you wear their white practice jerseys. And he said, hell, we didn't come up here to practice, son. We came to play. And there, and we finally convinced him to wear the jerseys. And then at the end of the game, Lenoir Rhine was ahead by like maybe less than a touchdown. And they were punting. on the last play of the game, and it was maybe, I don't know, 20 seconds left or something, and the ball is punted, and they let the ball roll around, and time runs out, and we start running off the field. And here came the coach screaming at me, "Where are you going? Where are you going?" I said, "Well, coach, the game's over." And he said, "Hell, it's the end of the third quarter. You can't go anywhere." I said, "Coach, the game is over. That's the fourth quarter." He was fired the next week for coaching while inebriated. So, but it really gave us an interesting evening, I promise you that.
Trust me, Jerry, I deal with that all the time here on this podcast with Adam Lucas. He just has a little bit of a longer rope than some others.
When you're out there with such talented players and coaches, and you're obviously a fan of the game, are you able to enjoy the high level at which they're playing, or are you so focused on whatever your specific responsibility is at that moment?
Well, you're certainly focused on the moment, but things happen, and you know we don't know the players individually. We know there's number 74 or number 82 or whatever, but we don't know who they are really. And but once in a while you'll see a play when you just think, holy cow, how did he do that? You know, how did he stay in the air and wait on that interception? Or how in the world did he twist and turn his body? He thought he was going to be tackled on the 7-yard line, and somehow he gets the ball to the pylon. You look at it and you think, did I really just see that? Did that really just happen? Because they are so athletic, and the speed of the game is so incredible that it's just you just see things out there that make you say, wow.
What level of teamwork is necessary for a crew to officiate at the level, at the highest level? Because obviously you're, as the referee, responsible for one portion of the game, the umpire is responsible for something else, et cetera. What is that level of teamwork, and how long does it take to get that chemistry?
Well, it takes a while. I was really blessed. I had the same line judge for 10 years. Bill Booker and I worked over 100 games together. And I could watch the quarterback's first two steps, and I knew where Booker was going to be, what he was going to do, and likewise with me. And so there was a high degree of confidence there. But the first few games you work with somebody, there's always a little, okay, I thought you were going to do this. I thought he was going to do that. And I didn't really care who the officials were on the field other than the one on my right and the one on my left. I always had the back judge on one side and the line judge on the other. As long as there were two guys I had a lot of confidence in, everything's going to be fine, because quite frankly, I'd go an entire game and might not even see the head linesman or hardly notice him or the side judge, because I was so focused on my area of the field with my two partners over there. But I noticed the ACC a lot of times over the year, even when I was a young official, they tried to have crews, but that was difficult for big games because you don't want to put a first-year guy in a big game. But they would team up the referee and the umpire, or they'd team up the back judge and the head linesman, or they'd team up the field judge and the line judge. And that seemed to work well for us because especially when we traveled and had split crews back in those days, it was always nice to have somebody with you that you did have a great deal of confidence in. But it really takes a while, and I just, one of the great blessings I had as an official was I had so many great partners. Rick Page was a tremendous ACC official, and Bill Booker and those guys, they helped me so much. Doug Rhodes was my back judge a lot of years, and of course Doug went on to be the coordinator of officials, but that is crucial, especially the bigger the game, the bigger the moment. You don't want to be second guessing the guys who are around you.
What's the hardest call? Is it holding? Is it pass interference? What's the hardest call?
I think where we are downfield, I think it's pass interference. Was it a rub? Was it interference? Was it a block? Was he holding? He had his hand on his back. Was he turning him or twisting him? You know, there's so much more. Just because somebody's touching somebody doesn't mean it's a foul. And when the ball is thrown in the air, it belongs to no one. it's it belongs to the defense as much as it does the offense. But you have to really let your mind digest what your eyes have seen. When you see those bang bang plays or close plays, somebody will, a lot of times somebody will say, that was a late flag. No, it wasn't a late flag. The official saw something, he was letting his mind digest what his eyes had seen, and then he made the call. Because, you know, it's a pass interference call here, a pass interference call there, can greatly affect the outcome of the game. So you want to be as exact as possible.
What's your thoughts on the targeting rule that has been introduced here recently, and how officials today are trying to call that and then adjudicate it?
Well, it is absolutely impossible to officiate the call. It's we all want the game to be safe. Heaven knows that's the real reason he originally had officials, were to try to make sure the players were kept safe. But it really has I don't see how in the world they officiate the call. When they first implemented the call, I was still officiate the rule I was officiating, and you could tell when someone was targeting someone. But I think there's a difference in targeting someone and helmet actually hitting somebody's helmet, or it's tough to call. They obviously are erring on the side of player safety. But I'll tell you, when a guy who's making about half your tackles gets booted out of the game in the second quarter or in the third quarter, it makes it very difficult for you. But it is a contact sport. But I think they've got to address it at the end of the year. Can there be targeting that results in expulsion and targeting which doesn't result in expulsion? That might be a good place to start.
We're fortunate to get to talk to Dre Bly pretty regularly, and we know from him that he never committed pass interference in his entire life, nor did he ever even think about committing pass interference. But I think I read in the book that you did flag him for pass interference on one occasion, but then you got some negative feedback for that call.
Yeah, he was so classy about it. I think that particular he intercepted would have probably broken the ACC record, but I had him for a foul before the ball got there, and he was good about it. He stood up and smiled, tossed me the ball, and went on about his business. But the next day, I was going to speak in a church over in Gastonia, and I was going through Charlotte, not much traffic going through downtown Charlotte on a Sunday morning. And this lady, this big black Cadillac, pulled up next to me. And I was probably, I don't know, 55, and she was probably 85. And she looked at me, and she tapped on a window. And I looked, rolled my window down, and she said, "Are you that Mr. McGee from out at Wingate?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." And she said, "Well, did you referee that game at Carolina yesterday?" "Yes, ma'am." She said, "Well, that pass interference on Dre Bly really sucked." Well, the light changed, and she drove off. And I'm sitting here like, I was just dressed down by an 85-year-old woman on my way to church because she obviously disagreed with my call. But Dre Bly was one of I think he and Donnell Walford and Deion Sanders were certainly the three best defensive backs I ever officiated.
Did you ever throw a flag and as it was laying there on the ground and you looked at it, you thought, I think maybe I should not have thrown that flag.
Yeah, by the time it hits the ground, you think, I wish I hadn't have done that. but I only had that happen once or twice, and fortunately, it was always in some small college game somewhere. And you know, I really appreciate the way they officiate now much better than when we did initially when I first broke into the game. We were told to call it emphatically, stick to your guns, and move on. And now, they, with the athleticism and the speed, there's some really tough calls, and they'll put the flag down. And two or three officials get together and talk about it, and they'll pick it up and wave the flag off and move on. Well, I think that's a great way to officiate, because at the end of the day, you want to get the call right. And what it looks like from your angle, look like a block in the back, the back judge might come in and say, Jerry, that really was from the side. And you talk about it and think through it and make the appropriate call and move on. But yeah, that was once or twice when I threw the flag, I thought, I'm probably not going to make any friends with that one. but it was, you know, just like the players and the coaches, 100% of the officials are humans. And so they're subject to make mistakes.
To that point, I think everybody's been in a game where the officials start talking and then they keep talking. And then all of a sudden it feels like it's been like 3 minutes and the crowd is getting antsy and there's some grumbles and boos. What are you guys talking about? What takes so long when those meetings start getting lengthy?
Well, I was never one for long meetings at my job or on the field. But I'm the worst guy in the world. My wife just laughs at me because if the officials talk too much, I'm screaming, what the hell are you guys talking about? Get over there and make the call and move on. And that happened one time in the game Monday night. I thought they had this long discussion on one sideline. Now they got to go and have a long discussion on the other sideline. But I was always one of those guys that get in there and get it done. I don't like replays lasting a long time. I don't like conversations lasting a long time. And I just don't think it helps the game.
How many times did you have trouble with your microphone when you were trying to announce calls? And is that like an awful feeling when everybody's looking at you and your mic isn't working right?
Well, I didn't have to deal with that much, but in the words of my great friend, Woody Durrell, we can send men to the moon back, but we can't get a field mic to work for the referee. I heard him say that 100 times, I'm sure. But that's the truth. They're getting a little smarter. They change the battery now, usually at the end of every quarter. And that was a problem in the past. The batteries would run out. And
are they just running on like AA batteries, or is it just normal Duracells or something in there?
Yeah, it's just a little cheap. But they come out now and use it in each quarter. They'll change the referee's mic. But it's, I don't know, things like that. You don't need anything to make the officials look bad. Heaven knows we have enough trouble anyway. But I always said to young officials, walk on that field with your best uniform, with your shoes shined, with a new hat, with a smile on your face, with your flag pushed all the way down in your pocket where you got to really think about it before you go get it. Hustle everywhere you go. Don't stand around and chatter all the time. Just work the game and move on. But just try to handle it as professionally as you can. And if you look good coming on the field, it's kind of like playing golf. I used to say, I couldn't play very well, but boy, I look great on the first tee. Well, you want to look great when you walk out on the field, because people already think you're a bunch of bums, and so you don't want to do anything to make them true.
What about that year y'all had to wear shorts? Did you feel like you were looking good on the first tee that season?
I did. I still have a picture somewhere of Doug Rhodes and myself, and our shorts one night over, I think it was over at Duke or somewhere, but we only got to wear them a short period of time because new commissioner came in and said, boys, the shorts have got to go. But I will say that there were a few guys who did not look quite as good in their shorts as I did.
You can't see it like we can on this call, but Jerry's kicking his calves up to the camera right now. We're getting a good look. We're impressed.
Well, first of all, those old sorry knit pants we had to wear were awful anyway. And I stayed on Dick Honig, who had a sporting good company, who was an official in the Big Ten. I stayed on him for 5 years about getting some more comfortable pants to wear. And he kept saying, we're working on it. But my last game was in January of 2009. In the fall of 2009, they had those new pants. Forget that. And those knit shorts were supposed to be comfortable for us when it was 100 degrees. But then they gave us these long white socks to wear that came up to our knees. So the only thing that was cool was our kneecap. But it was just a bad idea from the beginning, and so I think I might have worked 4 games in shorts.
Who started the trend of doing tremendous tricep and bicep work for the officials so that when they're like signaling first down, they're showing off their cannons there with their arms?
Well, I think Hockley in the NFL was the first one who did that. And, you know, he I think he started the trend, and the boys out in the Big 12 kind of picked up on it. And,
Who knows what they're doing out there? Big 12's like the Wild West. They're doing whatever they want out there.
Well, see the guys on the West Coast and the Midwest, they don't have to worry about being in the championship series. So they have plenty of time to go work out. It's a great time to be a Big 12 or a Pac-10 official because your teams are never in the playoffs, so you always get a playoff game. You know, the ACC guys and Southeast Conference guys, they get left out a lot because their teams are always playing.
Did you ever have the desire to go to the NFL?
Not even one second. I just I loved college football. I had two little boys at home that needed a lot more of my attention. I had a job where I had to travel like a crazy man. And it was never an interest of mine even for one day. I just this will sound terrible, but I think pro football is boring. I when I go to a Panther game by halftime, I'm saying, why in the world am I here? It's just a boring event. And, you know, I just don't enjoy that game very much. And college football is so much more exciting to me, and the crowds and the, you know, the tailgating and everybody having a big time before the game and cheering for their alma mater. To me, that's the epitome of football.
All right, Jones and I have potentially, I don't want to undersell it, $1 billion idea. And we might be willing to cut you in on this when we go pitch it on Shark Tank, since you have a little more insight than we do. We are baffled by the fact that in the year 2021, we are still measuring a first down with chains. What if there was a laser in the chains or in the down markers so that you don't have to run the chain out there and go and the ball moves back and forth several inches? You never really know, is it really where it's supposed to be? Boom, you just shoot the laser out of the down marker. Did he make it? Did he not? On we move. How many millions of dollars do you think we're going to make on this?
Not many.
It only takes one.
But I understand, I don't know this person, but I understand that the person who invented the first down stripe on the field, you know, right, for television, is from North Carolina. Mm. So the family's from Raleigh, but, and they've done so much now, you know, you can, I love the display now where it shows you in dark green how much yardage you got to get the first down and that sort of stuff. But I think it's a natural first step. I think you guys are on to a good idea. But as they would tell you on Shark Tank, I think you have a product, not a company, guys. but I do think it. I think it's a great idea. And takes, you know, would take 10 seconds to do it.
There we go.
How many times when are you 100% confident that every time the chain goes out there, the ball is exactly where it's supposed to be and the chain's where it's supposed to be?
Absolutely not.
See?
I'm confident the chains are where they're supposed to be. But when you move moving that football around and did it get 2 inches farther forward or where did you blow the whistle? That's an inexact science. I think you could always make a case that the ball could have been forward or backwards 4 inches here or 4 inches there, and as you know, very often that makes a big difference.
Did you ever get run over on the field? Did anybody ever run into you?
Oh Lord. Oh yeah. I got a cracked sternum up at Pittsburgh one day. I was stretched out giving a touchdown signal, and the defender was frustrated. He pushed the receiver from behind and his helmet hit me right in the sternum.
Whoa.
And cracked my sternum. So that made it kind of hard to give a timeout signal for the next few weeks. But it was, but the worst I ever really got hit was, I think we had NC State. We had Pittsburgh at Louisville. And I was running down. I was, as always, I was about 8 yards ahead of the runner, running down the field. And I was, as I was running backwards, I was watching his foot to see if he touched, stepped out of bounds. And he did. And when he stepped out of bounds, I stopped to go to the spot. That was a really bad idea. Because when I stopped, somebody pushed him from behind, and his helmet caught me kind of right under the left ear. Oof. And I literally was in the air for like 5 yards. And I hit the ground, artificial turf, hit the ground, my head hit the ground. And my mouth was bleeding. So I figured I'd lost a tooth or two. But of all things, there was a dentist on the sideline. He checked me out and said I was fine. So I don't want to have finished the game. But it was really funny. About 3 weeks later, I had a game at Pittsburgh, and Coach Majors came over and said, Jerry, are you okay? I said, yeah, I'm fine, Coach. He said, God, I've never seen anybody get hit like that. I said, well, it wasn't much fun. And he said, it was funny for me, because for the rest of the game, none of your answers fit my question. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, I walked over to you and said, Jerry, when we get the ball back, there's only about 2 minutes left, and we're going to do this, that, and such. I looked at him, and I said, Coach, I'm going to be at Ohio State next week. And he looked at me like, what the hell are you talking about? And he said, he asked me like three different conversations he tried to have with me, and none of my answers fit what he was talking about.
Somewhere so that old head coach at Lenoir Rhine is calling you out right now, Jerry.
I might have had just a touch of a concussion. But this is the funniest part. After the game, all the guys go out to dinner. Well, I don't feel like going out to dinner. So I was sitting in the room, I ordered a pizza. And the pizza delivery man came to the room. I walked to the door. He looked at me and he said, dang, are you that official that got hit today? And I said, well, yeah, but how'd you know that? He said, well, one, you still got on your uniform. He said, two is you got a knot right above your left eye. I said, yeah, I'm the guy. Give me the pizza and get out of here. But it was, that really hurt. And Ryan worked for ESPN at Connecticut, and they all ran down the hall and got him and said, come down here, we think your dad's dead. And that didn't help his feelings much. But it was all fine. By Tuesday, I was good.
You mentioned at the beginning you don't really hear the 85,000 fans screaming at you. But I have to think you do hear, as you just said, some of the head coaches and assistant coaches who are right in your ear.
Oh, yeah.
Who are some of the most memorable characters you interacted with in those situations when they're right there at you and you can't go away because it's your job to be standing there?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's just some funny lines. Danny Ford, he was very helpful on the field. He always had... He always had a lot of advice for you. But I think that the funniest thing was our mechanics are kind of strange. If a ball is kicked on one side of the field and the side judge and back judge have the runner, as a field judge, I've got the blockers coming down the field. And so sometimes you have to throw a flag a pretty far distance on a play like that. And I had a game out of Georgia Tech, and they were playing Troy. Right before the halftime, and I fired a missile across the field about 30 yards on the block in the back. And halftime came, and the coach of Troy walked by me, and he said, you might want to ice your arm down at halftime. I've never seen a damn flag thrown that far before. Well, that's pretty funny. But they were just trying to help us out and make sure that they were getting a fair advantage.
So – Mickey
Andrews down at Florida State, one of his greatest lines was, anytime an official comes to Tallahassee and doesn't have gray hair, it's my job to give him some. So Mickey was always a big help, too.
So I think that's right. Two Rose Bowls, a couple Army-Navy games, multiple national title games as well. Is there one that stands out to you, or is there a moment like that really is special for you now that you're out of the game?
Yeah, I think it was a special honor to get the 1991 Army-Navy game. It was on December the 7th. exactly 50 years after the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Wow.
And I went to get the Navy captains, and I came back with the captains, and I think it was a dozen admirals. And the Army captain, the Army captains came out, and they had about 12 generals with them. We go out to midfield, and we'd already watched all these kids march in, you know, for the game. And we have a flyover. We have the national anthem. And then the President of the United States addresses the world from the Arizona Memorial at Pearl Harbor. And then we had to play the game. Hell, I was worn out. I was emotionally wrung out. We hadn't even played yet. But that was a real, real moment to be there at that special time. And you know, when you officiate, guys, it's like playing or coaching. The only play that matters is the next play. The only game that matters is the next game. And you put your head down, you come to work every day, and you prepare and you do the best you can. The next week you go do another one and do another one. And you don't think about it while you're in the middle of it, but when you get to the end, and you look back and you think, 400 games, 26 postseason games, 14 Heisman Trophy winners, 30-plus colleges that are in college and College Football Hall of Fame, and you think, gee whiz, you know, to be a part of all that was a very special blessing. And you get them wrong sometimes, you get them right most of the time, but you just keep moving forward. And at the end, you allow yourself to look back and just realize how blessed you were and what a great experience it was.
Adam, what's the name of the book again? Jerry McGee's book?
Sidelines and Bloodlines.
Yeah. Check it out.
It really is a good book. A lot of the stories you heard Jerry McGee tell, but also many, many more, plus the very good writing of Ryan McGee, who, of course, does great work for ESPN.
Caroline, before we get to Adam's list, reminder that we're brought to you by Harris Teeter, and they're assisting you with groceries this basketball season. Each week, one winner will receive free groceries for every assist through the Big Four Grocery Assist Sweepstakes. Last week's winner, Carolyn from Greensboro. You know how much money in Harris Teeter gift cards Carolyn won last week, Adam?
$1 million.
Close, $515. Visit harristeeter.com and look for the Grocery Assist Sweepstakes section to enter.
I got so mad last week. I know that's hard to believe. Mm. I was watching...
You're raking leaves.
As you often do, I was watching the primetime Price is Right show.
Yeah, there's been a resurgence of primetime game shows. We've got Wheel of Fortune in primetime now.
They're all over the place.
I got to tell you, Pat Sajak, I like Pat Sajak.
Well, so the primetime Price is Right show, it was a socially distanced version of Price is Right, so a little different than what you know. But they were bidding to get up on stage. It frustrates me to no end when people don't understand how to bid. If you're the last bidder and the previous bids are, there was someone had bid $10,000, someone had bid $800, and then someone had bid $1,500. And my man, who was the last guy, bid like $8,200. Bro, no. $1,501.
Yeah.
That gives you everything from $1,501 to $99.99.
Feels like the right play.
That make the easy pass.
Yeah.
Make the easy pass. Don't be a hero and try to get it exactly right. First of all, I'm going to tell you, the prize that gets you up on stage is not $8,200.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's rarefied air we're talking about.
Even in prime time, the prizes aren't that big.
I saw a celebrity Wheel of Fortune and Terry Hatcher.
I saw that.
It seemed like Terry Hatcher had never heard of Wheel of Fortune. Did not know what the rules to Wheel of Fortune were. She was blown away that you could buy a vowel. Like, she didn't get it. Like, anytime she spun the wheel, she was like, ooh, like Terry, Wheel of Fortune's been around for decades.
The other stars on that show
were Drew Carey.
And who was the other one?
She's from that This Is Us show, but I don't know her name.
Chrissy Metz.
Okay.
Was it as obvious to you as it was to me? Pat Sajak really wanted Terry Hatcher to win.
Oh, well, yeah.
whatever he could do to assist Terry Hatcher, that's what he was there. And I think Drew Carey was onto it.
Yeah, oh yeah. I saw another one where Leslie Jones, the host of
Supermarket Sweep,
and she and Pat were going, they were trading barbs all show long.
Oh.
Yeah.
A foil to Pat's silliness.
Pat Sajak, what I respect about Pat is that he doesn't take himself too seriously, and he uses the dry humor throughout the show to just stick the knife in you.
Yep.
Love some Pat.
I think he misses not being able to walk around and chat with the contestants during these times.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it was Elaine Brewer Floyd who pointed out there's also a new primetime version of Name That Tune.
Yep, seen a little bit of that.
That show is good. I like that show.
People keep in the bid, so you know you can name that tune.
They don't know how to bid.
No, they're allowing their opponent way too many notes.
Look, five notes is more than you think.
Yeah, well, especially because they're going to play the recognizable part of the song.
Yeah, it's not the intro.
It's not the first five notes of the song. Like, there was one that I saw, Adam, where the clue was, like, her bodyguard, such and such, such. I was like, this is I Will Always Love You.
Yes.
Just say it's one note. You know what it is.
Yes.
And she like gave him six notes and it was like burr, 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 burr. And he's like, I Will Always Love You. Well, of course it is. And I
will always love you. There was on the first episode.
Also, why is Randy Jack? What happened to Randy Jackson?
I don't know.
Randy Jackson is 200 pounds skinnier than he was when he was on American Idol.
But he's got 100 pounds more inspiration.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Do we need Randy Jackson to provide the motivational speech right before the final round that is only really tangentially related to what they're about to do?
I don't get it. I don't get it at all. But like, Adam's in the championship round, right? And they'll be like, Randy, do you have any advice for Adam? And he'll be like, Adam, you can't shoot for the stars with your feet on the ground. Or something. It's like, what?
If you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. All right, here's the first clue.
Thanks, oddly skinny Randy.
On the first episode, one of the clues was something like, this song might have left Maverick breathless.
Oh, come on.
And they stopped the bidding at like eight notes. The first person, and then you've got the first person's like, I can name that tune in 10 notes. And the crowd goes, oh.
Keep in mind, 10 is the maximum amount of notes.
You might as well listen to the whole song.
Yeah, you can't say any more than 10.
So then Bobby or whoever comes back, he's like, I can do it in 9 notes. And then the other person's like, I can do it in 8. And Bobby was like, all right, go ahead, name that tune. How could you ever do it?
I don't like the host on Name That Tune. The woman.
She's not friendly enough.
No.
She's not.
No.
She's trying to be the Press Your Luck new host, Elizabeth Banks, who is good at it because like you feel like she actually likes the people.
Right.
I don't think the Name That Tune person really likes the people. Right. And I think she's just there for a paycheck.
Yeah.
You respect the sanctity of Name That Tune, and you act like you love it.
Yeah.
Like Randy.
Randy, that's right. That's right. Do you have any advice for Adam, Randy, as he goes into the final round? Adam, you can never be wrong if you trust the Lord. It's like, all right, here we go. It is like he has a calendar that has a motivational sentence for the day, and he just reads it.
It's kind of like Blodz's tweets.
Yeah, they make a little more sense than Blodz's tweets, but...
Well, kind of, but in the situation, not always.
Blodz had a bad day the other day because, of course, he's got the automatic, just like Mike Copeland's got the automatic, how many follow? It was like 8 people unfollowed me, no one followed me.
Oh, that's harsh.
Sorry, Blodz. Tough day. Tough week, bro. All right, where are we? Adam's list. Here we go.
What's on the top of Adam's list? Brought to you by Top of the Hill, where Tar Heels come to celebrate.
Okay. But that very easily could have been on my list.
Sure, yeah.
Did you see there's a new NCAA tournament bracketing procedure for 2021?
I did. One more thing. A lot of people like to say big money on the celebrity Wheel of Fortune when they're spinning the wheel because they're confused. It's not press your luck.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't say big money. Drew Carey was a big money guy.
Why would he do that?
Leslie Jones was, too. Yeah, spin and be like, come on, big money. It's like, no, wrong game.
Do you watch the show?
Yeah, wrong game.
Have you watched any more of the sweeps with Leslie Jones?
I have not seen a single episode of Supermarket Sweep with Leslie Jones.
But yet you have plenty of time for Wheel of Fortune, you little cheater.
Well, I have so much love for the 90s Supermarket Sweep. I feel like it may taint my Supermarket Sweep enjoyment.
I think you have to think of it as completely different.
Right.
It's not Supermarket Sweep 2.0. It's not Supermarket Sweep, this version.
It's not the Supermarket Sweep you know and love.
That's right.
All right, new bracketing procedures. I did see this, but I got to tell you, Adam, I didn't think they were... I opened this piece of news when I saw it, and I said, oh, this sounds like it could be interesting. Basically, since everybody's in the same place, they're not going to take geography into account. What a novel idea! So instead, they're just going to go ahead and rank everybody for how they have them on the S-curve.
Yeah, that's the procedure.
Yep.
We're using the S-curve. Strict S-curve.
That we use all the time.
So, I'm sorry, Duke. You will not be going to the Meadowlands.
Yeah.
You will be going to Hinkle Fieldhouse. Or whatever. But, kind of like you, I thought, oh, this seems like breaking news that I need to pay close attention to. Nah, it's just they're going to follow the S-curve. There's a few allowances for conference teams, but I think they only hold for the first round. So you could have a conference matchup in the second round, which, okay, that's fine. What up? To Arthur Smith, former Tar Heel offensive lineman, now coach of the Atlanta Falcons.
I'm getting a voice in my ear, Adam, that says, let's go to sideline correspondent Randy Jackson. And he has some words for Arthur Smith. Randy. Yes, Jones. I'd like to say this to Arthur. Push yourself because no one else is going to do it for you. All right, back to you. Wait. Adam, one more. If your dreams don't scare you, they're too small. All right, thank you, Randy.
I think he did say that one about the dreams not scaring you. I feel like I've heard that recently in a final round scenario.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what would be more helpful for Randy would be like, this round is heavy on 80s pop. Like, I would rather hear that.
Success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It is the courage to continue that counts. Thank you, Randy. Arthur Smith just like, okay, thanks, Randy. I'm trying to give my speech here. Accepting the job.
I really believe in the 4-3 defense.
Special teams will be important to me.
I'd like to thank Mr. Blank, one of the finest owners in all of sports. So what a rocket ship ride for Arthur Smith. It wasn't that long ago that he was just a graduate assistant on the Carolina staff.
Yeah, that's right.
Now he's one of 32 head coaches in the entire world in the NFL.
Now, here's the thing. Falcons have talent, Adam. Quarterback, though, he's got to make a choice there. That's a hard. You're not walking into, the Chargers job. You're walking into, hey, I've got a young quarterback that's my guy for the next 7 years. That's the only tough part. You got to make a tough decision there.
Maybe Arthur's just going to trade for Deshaun Watson.
Yeah, easy enough.
He seems unhappy where he is, and I heard he'd like to play for Arthur Smith. That's what I heard.
Yeah, the rumor.
Yeah. Mr. Goose Honkers tweeted to the pod, says he's late to this one, but he has a hype song recommendation. As you remember, we're trying to put together a playlist for middle school virtual girls basketball Zoom sign-ins.
Yeah, right.
We're trying to address the important issues of our time. And Mr. Goose Honkers says he's a little ashamed of this, but John Cena's The Time Is Now really gets my wings flapping in pregame. I Did not know that song.
Well, I have told you before, Adam, either on this pod or off the pod, that wrestling, because John Cena is a wrestler.
Right.
Or used to be. I don't even know if he still does.
He is in my heart.
They're like intro songs. Those can get pretty hype. So we'll do some research for you and add that. So you're probably hearing that song under us talking right now.
You're probably getting hype right now, and you're not sure if it's because of the music or because of Randy Jackson's inspirational words.
A little bit of both.
But it's one of the two. What if Randy Jackson provided his inspirational words to the backing vocals of a WWE intro?
Yeah, yeah. I think we'd all be ready to run through a brick wall at that point.
Yep. Sean Patrizzi, I thought this was a great idea.
Okay.
As you know, on the last episode, we talked about the possibility of ACC expansion coming up. That's been floated out there because some people think the ACC TV contract is not lucrative enough and it runs through 2035. So in order to get a new contract, you have to have new teams. Sean says, very biased, as we know, Sean has a connection to Navy. But I think a very interesting consideration for ACC expansion is Navy. Tradition like no other. Not unlike any other, but very similar. National brand, huge fan base, fits the geographical footprint, fits academically, nationally relevant in many Olympic sports, solid fringe top 25 football for most of the past decade. Biggest negative, Sean says, is lack of basketball success since David Robinson. From a fan perspective, a very unique and fun road trip. I think I could go for Navy.
I certainly agree that Annapolis is a cool place to go. I think Sean lays out the pluses and minuses very well. I do wonder if the total lack of basketball, it hurts.
Is their I guess their basketball is worse than Virginia Tech basketball before they joined the ACC.
I would think so. Well, again, they're recruiting. It's just a different student that they have. I think you could make the argument, let's just say you think Virginia Tech was worse back then. Well, but Virginia Tech can now use being in the ACC, which they have done well, to improve dramatically because they're not recruiting the same people Navy is. And so I think you can be successful in football, as Navy has proven that it can be. I think it's harder in basketball.
But does it matter?
Right. That's the other question is, does it matter? I don't know.
Is
it a big enough fan base? And is the football relevant enough? That would be the question, I think.
You got to remember, you have to think like 2021 college sports. You're not really trying to make a cohesive league. You're trying to make a television show.
Right.
They make a good television show.
Mm. Here's another question. Do you want to have to deal with the option once a year again? We just
got rid of Paul Johnson.
Yeah, we just got rid of Paul Johnson.
Well, but for all we know, Carolina would only play them every 6 years.
Yeah, also true.
I also think if you have Navy in, does that make Notre Dame cast another glance your way? Mm. They love Navy.
Yeah, they are BFF. I don't know.
You're basically trying to hit on the friend to try to get the really hot girl that you're trying to get.
Hold on, Adam. Let's go to Randy real fast. Yeah, Randy, what do you say about ACC expansion? Thank you, Jones. Don't limit your challenges. Challenge your limits. Excellent. Thank you, Randy.
last thing on the list. We got...
This was close to a little Sebastian list.
It was close, but not quite. We got an email from our good friend Isaac. He did the research on this question. I don't know if this research is correct, but because Isaac did it, I deem it to be most likely accurate. He heard Trey Whittington's email on Friday's pod and the question about how often it's occurred that Carolina has won on the same day that Duke, Kentucky, and Kansas have all lost.
Mm-hmm.
Isaac went back as far as the 1969-70 season. The Trey termed Rushmore solo or blue blood inside straight. I like the blue blood inside straight better. Yeah. Has occurred 12 times in that span. It occurred far more frequently in the 70s and 80s. Well, some of those teams were down then. It happened twice in one season in 72-73 and 81-82. It didn't happen at all from January of 89 to March of 05. So that's more frequently than I would have guessed. Of course, as we know, the most recent occurrence was January 12th of 2021. Prior to that, last time it had happened was 2018.
Wow. Man, what research.
Yeah.
One more email I want to get to, but first we got to tell you that we're brought to you by UNC Healthcare, dedicated to caring for champions of all kinds and to help keep you in the game and at your very best. See their lineup at unchealthcare.org/sports. Adam, got an email from Dennis Goss, and we, as you know, Adam, have been mentioning the Coca-Cola Carolina basketball cards here as of late. Dennis sent in this email. He said, "I hope the new year finds you well." Well, thank you, Dennis. Same to you, sir. "The recent pod mentions of Carolina trading cards reminded me of an interesting collectible that his mother left to Dennis some years ago. It's a deck of Carolina playing cards, he said, from circa 1977, and it is an homage to early Carolina basketball stars. When he got the deck, he was excited to research the history of the players depicted, spent some time looking up the names to find the years they played. He said the players depicted range from Hook Dillon, the All-America who attended Carolina in the 40s, all the way to Tommy Lagarde, Bruce Buckley, John Kuster, who was the Carolina class from 73 to 77. After the recent trading card mentions, I got the deck out to look it over again, and what a coincidence to see the King of Hearts was George Karl. He's wearing a turtleneck that, to Dennis, looks exactly like the one that he wore in the marketing photo that Adam and I talked about on the Social Drive segment of the last video pod. Whew. Synergy. So Dennis held the card side by side with his Twitter post and verified that it is indeed the same turtleneck. He's included a list of the cards and players depicted. He said, if Jones is calling out names from the photos and leaves someone out, the audience should know it is. Thank you, Dennis. It is not my fault, Jones's fault, because I'm just reading the list that Dennis provided. He said, Dennis said, as an aside, Dick Grubar is the Four of Hearts, and his caption ironically reads, always underrated. He said, other personal card favorites for Dennis, the Ace of Spades is a dapper Dean Smith. The Queen of Clubs is Larry Miller. The Queen of Hearts is a cheerleader, Laylee McNair. The Ace of Diamonds, Bobby Jones. The Eight of Diamonds, Walter Davis. Thanks and go Heels. And so then Dennis sent a bunch of pictures of these cards. Adam, I've never once seen these.
I haven't either, and we'll show this on the video pod on Thursday so that you can see what we're talking about. Maybe you've got a deck of these cards, but I have to say, I've never seen them before. Well, I feel like Walter Davis is underrated at the eight of,
yeah, that's
what
a
you
very,
say, eight of diamonds?
That's a very common card for somebody who was an extraordinary player and a former guest on the pod.
I'm Walter Davis, and I'll see you later, Big Grits.
A lot of former pod guests on there. I bet the battle for King of Hearts was intense when they were deciding who to put on there. But George Karl rolled up with the turtleneck on, and they're like, oh, okay.
Well, Dennis gave us a list, and the problem is I'm having to turn my head to see it because it's not angled the right way here. But, you know, there were some where, like, the Jack of Spades was, like, the 69 ACC champs, for example. Mm. So it's kind of the same feel as those Coke cards, but in a playing deck form. I mean, I'm stunned that you've never seen this before because Adam likes to collect things. I've never seen.
I like my knickknacks.
Yeah, I would have thought you would have seen these before.
I have never seen them before.
Okay, last thing before we go. I've been getting a lot of guff, Adam, for my autocorrect on my phone. Everybody's acting like I should just, oh, what a rookie. Turn your autocorrect off. Yeah. Do you have your autocorrect off?
No, I do not.
Is that like a common thing that everybody does?
Well, that's the first thing my son said. We were listening to the pod in the car, and he goes, why doesn't he just turn it off? And I said, well, number one, I didn't know that was a choice. And number two, sometimes I do want autocorrect when I make dumb mistakes.
Hunter Lambert said it was an amateur move and I should turn off autocorrect and turn on spell check.
So that's two different things?
According to Hunter Lambert.
Is that what you're going to do, or are you going to play it as it lies?
I don't know. I think just like with dark mode, I think I may just kind of test out the spell check and turn off autocorrect for a couple of days and see how it feels.
So is spell check naturally on or off? Like, let me just check and see what I've got here. Everyone just wait there and listen while I look this up on my phone.
While you wait, why don't we ask Randy Jackson to help us out here? Adam, Randy says that obstacles are the cost of greatness.
Okay. Wow, I've got a lot of options on my keyboard. So I've got one-handed keyboard off. That sounds like something I might want. Mm. One-handed keyboard? I've got everything turned on. I'm all green all the way down, just like in every aspect of my life. Auto capitalization on, auto correction on, check spelling on. Mm. I've got it all. I feel like many of these things I want. Enable caps lock? Why would I want to turn off enable caps lock?
Sometimes you need to be all caps.
Smart punctuation is on. Slide to type. Don't know what that is.
I don't like slide to type. That's just when you move your thumb like in the general. You never take it off the screen and you move it in the general area of the letter and it seems to know what you type.
Oh, so I could turn that off because I don't like doing that.
Probably save you some battery.
Delete slide to type by word. Probably don't want that either. Turning that off.
Yeah, that sounds complicated.
Character preview is on and the period shortcut is on. That says double tapping the space bar will insert a period followed by a space. Now, I do want that. Mm. I use that all the time.
Oh, I've never used that.
Oh, yeah. I use that all the time.
Mm. Well, look at us, Adam. We're learning something here today. Okay. We're back later in the week. Guests, maybe a NC State preview, maybe not. Or we might do one that's then deemed irrelevant. We don't know.
For the third time this year.
Yeah, we don't know. We'll have, we think we'll be able to recap this Wake Forest game. Reminder that there will be a Rapid Reactions video pod after the Wake Forest game. And now it's a little bit earlier, so you don't have to stay up super late. It'll be available on demand afterwards as well. We have a video pod coming up on Thursday, too.
So, with playing cards.
Yeah, we're going to show some of those playing cards from Dennis Goss on that show and a lot more. So we got a bunch coming up. But for now, let's let Jerry McGee and the RZA, two long good friends, get us out of here on the Carolina Insider.
This is Jerry McGee. See you later, Big Grits.
When I was small, we had nothing at all. We used to eat grits for dinner.
Pound box of sugar and a stick of margarine. A hot pot of grits kept my family from starving. Steamy hot meal served less than 5 minutes. Big silver pot boiling water salt in it. House full of brothers and sisters, the pot's missing. Pilgrim on a box on the stove in the kitchen.
When I was small, we had nothing at all.
See you later, Big Green.
The preceding has been a Learfield IMG College presentation of the Tar Heel Sports Network, brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.